Good morning, everybody. Please be encouraged either to look up here or keep your eyes in the Zazen posture as suits you. This week on Thursday, I guest taught at a Sangha members class at Bentley College, Pierce's class. It was a class called Literature of the Spiritual Path. And his students wrote up little blurbs about their experience. I just wanted to read you a sentence from one of them. I thank Josh for letting us know how powerful meditation can be and for being a living example of the calamity that it can bring. You're welcome. Thinking of adding that to my teacher bio. But that's not what I'm going to talk about this morning. So we read this piece called in our sutra book, An Unending Truth. This is from the Dhammapada. This is the Buddha's kind of poetic summation of the entirety of the path. And it begins with, phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a darkened heart, then suffering follows you, as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you, like a shadow that never leaves. That person insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. That person insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled. And so I want to talk about how empowering this is. And I want to talk about it in the context of selfing. Selfing is, in Buddhist teachings, in our understanding, there is no fixed, unchanging, essential nature of self. There is no fixed, separate, and unchanging thing that is us. And yet, there is a self that arises, moment after moment, in each moment. It arises, it passes away, it arises again. One of my favorite images for this is the ongoing process of a little whirlpool eddy in a stream. Right, so the rocks and the sticks and the flow of the water are just so, the causes and conditions are just so, such that there's this little whirlpool that goes on for some period of time. But at no moment is that whirlpool the same whirlpool as another moment. It's all part of the stream streaming. And at some point, my teacher James, he calls this whirlpool James-ishness, self-ness, Josh-ishness. And then at some point the causes and conditions change. The rock shifts. The water in the stream is flowing faster or less fast, more or less. A stone gets washed away and that whirlpool is not there. But it's still the stream streaming. So where are these places we can see self vividly arise? One of the names in the Pali Sutras that the Buddha calls Mara. Mara is the he's called Mara the deceiver. He is the personification of suffering causing stuff. He's also called Mara the evil one. And a reminder that in Buddhism, evil is not an ontological identity. Evil is just the name for stuff that arises out of grasping aversion and delusive certainty. breed anger and ignorance. So he's called Mara the Evil One, Mara the Deceiver. He's also called the Home Builder. And this refers to the home builder of self, the continually building this self and creating this self. We, just a little Jungian aside here, when you have a dream and there's a house, you should consider that house may represent yourself and see what that unfolds. But so, where do we see this selfing happen? And one place that I have been really observing recently, this process of selfing, my own coming into being and bringing suffering along with that coming in, is in traffic, in driving. And it's such a great, and I've actually really this week been appreciating it as a really a laboratory kind of condition for me to go and observe the functioning of my own grasping aversion and stories about the way life should be. I recently told someone a story about my stepbrother, who is not at all a Zen practitioner. One time in I think maybe it was shortly after college, I was riding in his car with him, and he was driving, and we were, merging onto the, onto the highway from the ramp, and there was another car coming down the highway, and as we were moving on, he yelled, "Me!" and just slammed on his accelerator, and it was just such a pure illustration of such a unmediated kind of illustration of this thing that we're always doing. Me! 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 and I see this happening. Like I'm coming down Cambridge Street. There's a lot of traffic. Somebody is trying to turn left in front of me, and I think, me, I can't be bothered to let this guy in. And then I see that. Sometimes I don't see it until after I've not let that guy in. Right, and then I notice. Right, what am I doing here? And I'm seeing how much I have a story of I am much more important. I have a story of the way things should be, the way traffic should be, and it's such a great opportunity because. Rarely am I rushing to the hospital with a pregnant family member in the back seat, right? And rarely am I in a circumstance where it actually does need to be me. And yet I see how compulsively, how just habitually and automatically I act as if that's not true, right? And I act as if I am so incredibly important and everything needs to go my way, or a guy cuts me off, or a person is merging, doing that thing that some people do of driving in the lane that is ending, and then merging way in front of them instead of back in the back like everybody else. And I see my story of aversion and anger and I'm not going to support that behavior in that guy. And I don't enjoy that all that much. It really is apparent to me how much in that moment the self that arises for me is doing very, very little in the universe other than creating suffering for me. And so kind of a little bit what I've been experimenting this week is really noticing that, noticing the arising of of these things and taking these opportunities to practice detaching, unattaching from that story, letting go, the practice seeing that all that's happening is a grasping on to my certainty that I should be two cars in front, or an aversion to the additional 5, 10, 15 seconds, 2 minutes of time that it would take if there were one other car in front of me. And seeing that, and then actually remembering to not spare the Dharma assets, to generously, holding nothing back, let a person in. I when I'm practicing this way, I kind of let a person in at every opportunity. I don't let all the people in, but I let in one. And the value of doing this, the value of practicing that way, is not that it makes me a better person. It's not that it makes the world a better place, although it may. But it is that for me, when I am practicing that way, my drive through traffic is much less excruciating for me. And each time I get to practice this opportunity of, right, here's that aversion. Here's that selfing that says I am the most important thing in the universe. That's actually not true. And I'm going to let this pedestrian cross this crosswalk in accord with Massachusetts state law. And even just by doing that, by taking that opportunity of not breaking Massachusetts state law as an opportunity to practice opening my heart, to practice releasing my grip of selfing on aversion and delusive certainty and the story of I need to get home or wherever. This is kind of the empowering thing about phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. Our experience of phenomena, the way we experience phenomena, is ruled by the heart. By what we do matters. How we stand in relationship to it matters. With the example of the guy who's driving in the lane that's ending trying to merge in front of me. That person insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me, tried to merge in front of me. For those who brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. That person insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. And I imagine that I am in some kind of, I almost have an image of myself as some kind of god of wrath, dispensing justice onto this fucker, right? That's not even happening, right? My letting him in, not letting him in, whatever the hell I'm doing, whatever I imagine I'm doing on behalf of the universe has extremely nothing to do with this guy, right? So, like, actually dispensing justice in this moment is not on the table for me, right? The only thing that's on the table is creating more or less suffering for myself, right? And so, what if we actually take up this practice? So I'm experimenting with seeing just how compelling that is, how easily I, with all my God knows how many years of Dharma practice and all the Dharma books I've read, and I come here every day, how so quickly my own grasping aversion and delusive certainty and stories catch me up, and all of a sudden I'm trying to dispense wrath. And in the middle of that, I am really upset, right? And so the possibility of the Dharma, the empowerment of the Dharma is, so how about if we just let that guy be that guy? We acknowledge the reality that I can't actually dispense any justice here, and that the only thing I can do is practice with my heart. Meet these phenomena preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. That person insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me, cut me off. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is still. This is an opportunity for me to practice with that. And it's not a should. It's not a moral and ethical, you know, you should be a good, generous, patient, compassionate guy who just is like, yeah, whatever, it's all good. It isn't about that at all. It is actually about if I actually want to create less suffering, especially for myself, the thing for me to do is not brood on that. Let him in. And return, you know, he's presumably like me, acting from selfing. He's acting from me, right? And so this is also an opportunity for me to look at this guy and go, I know, right? Me. God, that's so compelling. I am like that too. That happens to me so quickly. Yeah. And you know, the thing I know about this guy, about when that happens, is I'm actually suffering a great deal. Oh man, that dude, he's actually suffering a great deal. You can go in, man. If that will help your suffering, you know, being one car in front of me, you should do that, buddy. You know? So this is also a practice of compassionate non-attachment. And it's a practice, the function of compassion, the way compassion functions in Zen is not that we it is not that we feel some special saintly way, but that we recognize how quickly and easily we ourselves personally cause and experience harm when we're acting from grasping, aversion, and delusive certainty. And then when we see somebody else doing that, we can respond by recognizing, right, I'm like that too. That really hurts. And this gives us space and flexibility in how to respond to the world. And even in the cases when some driver, you know, does something that puts me in potential danger, you know, like they swerved out without looking or something, you know, and I'm really angry about that, you know, and that's clearly a violation of our civic covenant of whatever we're doing on the road. But the thing is, I've actually done that. There but for the grace of God go I. I haven't actually ever injured somebody or killed anybody with my car, but I have gotten honked at because I was about to do something, you know, like that. Or because I didn't see a person, right? And I know that I am actually not an evil and malicious person. And I know how just devastatingly horrible I would feel if I ever did do that, right? And so what if that person who just nearly killed me is actually like me? What if that person is not a separate kind of being that is ontologically evil, but is just somebody caught up in grasping aversion and stories in that moment? And what if I were to actually take a moment to be grateful that that being doesn't have to bear the karma of having, you know, killed me? And there, but for the grace of God, go I. And so this is the way we practice with our hearts and move through the world. We practice with our hearts and minds, with our arising of grasping, aversion, and stories. And this is how we enact freedom from suffering. This is how we still the hostility of our own hearts and find peace. And in Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow, which we also read, if someone turns against us, speaking ill of us and treating us bitterly, cutting us off in traffic, nearly running over our foot, abusing the merging lane, this is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own suffering-causing attachments. The very ones, imagine, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. Each time this flare of anger arises, there is an opportunity, there is a possibility of meeting that as a big neon arrow from the Buddha saying, this thing, this, there, that selfing, that's what I'm talking about. That's the thing. Practice with that. Go! And this actually is a possibility. And so all the Dharma asks for us is doing what we can, when we can, and the amount we can. Doesn't ask us to do what we can't do. It doesn't ask us to do what we can do when we can't do it. And it doesn't ask us to do more of it than we can. And so there's actually no need to be engaged in the endless self-recrimination of oh man, I just yelled at that guy. But when you have the opportunity, when you are able to take this opportunity, the Dharma encourages you to do that. And the thing is that when we actually practice remembering the Dharma, right, which is another way of saying practice mindfulness, then we notice, right, this is an opportunity. My anger itself is a reminder that here's an opportunity. Anytime you're angry, anytime you're selfing, let that hold up the, let the little teeny, teeny little light go on saying, maybe you might want to try right here. You'll fortunately get a bajillion of those moments just today. And if you can take one of those, that's great. And if you can't, you'll get a bajillion more tomorrow. This is the endless generosity of the Dharma. Thank you, everybody. So I want to encourage you all to sit comfortably and to come forth in Dharma dialogue to resonate or ask or share.
As you're talking about your traffic stuff, I realize that the thing that kind of makes myself just up is slightly different, and that's when I'm falsely accused of something. I remember reading in Robert Aiken about injured innocence one time, and had an experience where at a retreat where I'd been falsely accused of something by a boss, and realized that fit this case. I mean, so for me in traffic, it's not so much when someone cuts me off, but like, you know, you're at a red light, the light turns green, and the person behind you honks a nanosecond after the change. I mean, that's the one that's like, you know, I'm falsely accused. They've said I'm something wrong. Boom.
Right. It's an affront to our story of who we are, right?
Yeah.
And I think you actually observed this, that sometimes when we see somebody suffering, part of what's hard for us is that our inability to help them is a affront to our self-image as a good helper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see how much of our I notice this. So when I work in Davis Square and I go out for lunch and I pass a guy selling the Spare Change newspaper, and I always buy it. And then I come back and he asks me again. And I realize how kind of much that, how I see vividly that that a part of the reason I buy it is because I want credit for being the good guy. Yeah. And you know, he asked me for it again. And I'm like, no, I'm one of the good ones.
Yeah.
No, I did that. And you know, so I could buy it in both directions. There's actually no reason I couldn't do that. And I also take it as an opportunity to see how much my like generosity is, to see the arising of my own kind of selfing and even in generosity, and how I'm, and so I take that opportunity to see how vividly I am attached to my self-image of being recognized as good. So it's actually it's a great practice, and it's painful. Thank you, Julie.
I was thinking when we first read this liturgy piece this morning that the difficulty is in bridging that gap, moving from, you know, I've been wronged to not buying into that. You know, how do you make that transition? And it reminded me of some years back when I was involved in cognitive behavioral therapy. Nobody's seen that. And there was this technique called acting as if. And it was really a brilliant thing to do because you didn't have to let go of your integrity in saying, no, I was wrong. You know, you didn't have to change that story. You just had to act, right? It was a little bit of a self-deception. And so you act as if you feel, you know, love or whatever for this person, whatever is the opposite of how you're actually feeling. And you get to experience what that is. But the truth of it is that in even accepting the exercise, you've already started to turn toward it. You've already loosened the grip just a little bit,
right.
And the crack is there, and then it can widen. So a wonderful juxtaposition of Zen and psychology.
Yeah, and that actually is the guiding principle, essentially, of Tibetan Buddhist Tantra. And another name for Tibetan Buddhist Tantra, they call it practicing the result. And so this is basically meeting the world as if you were a Buddha, and meeting the arisings of all of your selfing as if you were a Buddha, meeting other beings as if they are Buddhas and we are Buddhas. And as Kate is pointing to, this as if there's actually a way in which even if we use as if to trick ourselves, we're still actually doing the thing itself. And part of what the permission of this as if does is. So what if I were to meet this as if it were an opportunity to practice? What if I were to meet this guy cutting me off as if it actually weren't about me or this guy, but were actually an opportunity? And part of what that as if does is it kind of defuses us from our thoughts. Our thoughts we take as truths, we take as the fundamental essence of ourselves. But when we bring in this quality of as if, then we are entertaining the notion that just because it arises as a thought, it might not necessarily be universally defining as true. And this is also this is the same skill that we are practicing in Zazen each time we sit still when we have an impulse to move and run away. Each time we unhook from a story and come back.
Hey, So I have a, this reminded me of a kind of tricky situation that I encountered a few months back, where I had a friend who I found out was doing a lot of drunk driving, which was like totally shocking to me. And what I did was I thought to myself, I'm nothing like this person. This person is clearly just a terrible, ontologically evil person. I'm just not going to associate with them at all anymore, and really like separate myself completely. So what I'm having trouble with is, if I'm not going to do this self thing, or going to try to avoid that, then what I'm left with is I have to kind of meet this person again and do something. And then also accept them to some degree for who they are. I mean, still try to, you know, stop the drunk driving, because that's a serious issue, but I'm having trouble with, like, how do I stop othering?
I'm not sure it's a self and other kind of thing. I mean, you don't need to put it in any particular terms, right? You just need to go communicate with this person again and see what's going on. It's more what you can do with yourself to say, I'm also kind of like this person. You know, I've had moments of terrible judgment where I just did what I wanted to do. And then you have a bridge, right, of a way to relate. Can you imagine doing that?
And I think that what you said, so your first impulse was to conclude he was an ontologically evil thing, like there's a self-existent evil thing there, and that you needed to separate from that, right? And by acknowledging that that's actually not true, then you know that, and then that means you need to approach and in the service of all beings, and in the service of yourself, right? By recognizing that even though we have the arising of the story of that person is definitely bad and wrong and evil, that is not a truth, right? And that there's actually a thing that needs care for right now. And how much more effective at getting this dude to stop doing that you'll be coming from a place of, he is not bad and wrong and other, but he is actually a suffering human being, just like you are a suffering human being, right? And also there's an element of compassion that, you know, it's like I was saying about how glad I am that person didn't incur the karma of hitting me with their car, right? You don't want him to have the karma of the consequences of drunk driving, which can be quite massive and far-reaching karma, you know. And so it's from this place of care for yourself, for him, and for all beings. And that the amazing thing is that actually, whether you're doing it for yourself or for him or for all beings, it actually all points to the exact same thing, like two arrows meeting in midair. Amazing. And thank you for your care in this matter.
Thank you so much for your brilliant Dharma talk. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to be an example of the calamity.
Brilliant. And for me, it was really quite brilliant and moving. And there was so much in it that I just kept going, me too, me too, me too. And the part that really kind of started, you know, moving really strongly in me was... when you talked about the hostility, and my mind went back to an accident that I was in over 30 years ago, where I was on the recipient end of being injured, seriously. And it took me over 2 years to get past the sort of the pain that I was in, and then I still carry the effects of that accident today. And at that time, I was just so angry at the person. You know, when you said, like, when you were talking about that person that was trying to merge, and like, what if he's, you know, and in my head I was like, what if he's not an asshole, right? What if he's not intellectually an asshole? You know, because that's how I saw the person that caused the accident, that where I was so badly injured. And what I just want to really appreciate today is what you've held up as this invitation of what if there's another way to meet this? Even just, if I can't even imagine it, because at that time, I couldn't even imagine another way to meet that situation other than like, that asshole, you know, I wouldn't be in this pain, I wouldn't be in this bad situation if it weren't for this jerk, you know. And I couldn't even imagine another way to meet it at that time. And of course, over the years, other ways to meet it have arisen, thankfully. And so I just really wanted to say thank you for the reminder, even to just ask myself that question. Mm-hmm. Is there another way I could meet this? Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe I can't at that moment, but even just asking myself the question can open that little bit of space for me to let go of like how I'm so sure that I have to meet it right now, you know, and hang on to it. This hostility, this this little hard-heartedness that that grabs on. Mm. Thank you.
And this is really important, you know. And the reason that we do this. Is not is as the Buddha says here, because we're here on the verge of perishing, all of us. These are our companions in life and death. This brief human life, regardless of ecological destruction, this brief human life. We're here on the verge of perishing, and do we really? Is it the best choice even for us to brood on that? To brood on that asshole? And there's a real, and this is also kind of part of the power of the five remembrances, that we are all of the nature to get sick, grow old, and die. And this is quite a cliff that we're on the edge of.
Yeah, there it is. So it's interesting, a lot of stuff came up for me. But I find that I do not have the opportunity to not brood on it many times. Okay, I'm not going to brood on it, it comes up, and I just keep, it almost makes it worse, trying to not brood on some things that happen, and they just come up, and come up, and come up, and come up, and I'm stuck there sometimes.
Yeah, so each one of those come up. Is an opportunity, and it really doesn't matter if a bajillion go by. And if there's no opportunity, if there's no choice point for you to do something different, there's no choice point. There's no choice point. But then in a certain moment, maybe when you come to the Sangha, maybe when you come to Zazen, maybe when you make a bow, there's one little teeny opportunity to, in that micro mind moment, unhook from that story of brooding, and we don't we as you all can verify, we never unhook once and for all, and then we're set and done, right? And there's no rollover minutes, there's no credit for past times that you've unhooked, you know, and so but when there's no opportunity for choice, there's no opportunity for choice. But when there's a little bit of an opportunity, the encouragement of the Dharma is that it's worthwhile to take the opportunity to practice right then, even for that micro moment. And this is what we are literally practicing in Zazen. Each time we unhook from a story and come back to the breath, back to just this. Each time we desist from adding more fuels onto the fires of thinking and judging and grabbing on and pushing away. Doesn't mean those things don't happen, but it means we stop adding active energy into that. Each time we do that, we are practicing that skill, and we're also laying the karmic groundwork for us to have a fighting chance, a snowball's chance, of being able to kind of execute this on the fly in our lives, in traffic, in wherever. Part of what we are cultivating in Zazen, part of what we are strengthening is the heart muscle that allows us to be choicefully present. And it doesn't mean that we then become this thing that is choicefully present. It means that in any given moment we have a little bit of an opportunity. And then all of the actual humans I know miss a vast number of those moments, but sometimes you can catch one.
Cheek, but it was easier to receive all those blows than to turn the other cheek, because in the other cheek there was nothing. So it's easier to meet the world that way, with the identity, getting your identity from these struggles that you have. Being able to switch and accept.
Yeah, there's a line. Somewhere talking about Dharma practice as the school of many blows. John?
I guess when we were reciting that piece, I was thinking of the precept of not harboring ill will.
Right.
And so for me, I guess I look back and I really am like an elephant. Like, that person did me wrong 15 years ago, and it was probably meant to fire, but I remember it, and so I kind of, like, how can I remember and not harbor it, but also, to some extent, like, looking back on past relationships, and God, it was an asshole, but 10 years later, what was my and so it sort of opens it up a little bit for me to let some of that go.
Yeah, and this is a super important point. So when we recite the precepts, we say, transforming suffering into wisdom of how to take up the way of not harboring ill will. So, and I really like, I much prefer the phrasing not harboring ill will to not being angry. So anger arises. And when anger arises, that is actually this opportunity to transform suffering into wisdom. That is an opportunity. And when we meet that anger as the Buddha's arrow saying, here's that selfing, here's that thing, and we turn towards it in that moment with our hearts, that is in that moment using suffering as an opportunity to meet wisdom. And we can do this in the moment. We can do it retroactively 10 years later. And this is why this is why it's here, not harboring ill will. Because anytime we are actively fueling that ill will, we are not taking the opportunity to actually practice with our personal heart.
I remember, I forget when this was, I must have been in high school when I was reading this Brad Warner book. He said, anger is the difference between what you want and the way things really are. That made so much sense. And yeah. I'm sure I'm kind of reiterating what people have been saying, but it's just so interesting how personal you take things.
Yeah.
You know? It's like that person, that motherfucker, did this one thing and now my whole day is ruined. You know? And it's odd because even when I think back to when I on purposely tried to hurt someone, it wasn't even that I was really trying to hurt them at all. It was always just some sort of manifestation of what was really going wrong with me.
Right. Right. And what if that's true of every being you see? So important. And this business of not taking it personally. You know, so three of the essential truths of Buddhism are the truths of the existence and the fact of suffering and unsatisfactoriness. And another one is the truth of impermanence. And the third one is the truth of no fixed self. Suffering, impermanence, and no self. And another way of saying this is life sucks, things change, and it's not about you. Thank you, everyone.